You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a new conversation with Stephen P. Kiernan, whose new book is The Baker's Secret, just out from William Morrow. As a journalist and novelist, Stephen P. Kiernan has published nearly 4 million words. His newspaper work has garnered more than 40 awards, including the George Polk Award and the Scripps Howard Award for Distinguished Service to the First Amendment. Author of the novels The Hummingbird, about which we spoke a few years ago, and The Curiosity, he has also written two nonfiction books, Last Rites and Authentic Patriotism. His new novel, The Baker's Secret, came out May 2nd. Stephen was born in Newtonville, New York, the sixth of seven children. A graduate of Middlebury College, he received a Master of Arts degree from Johns Hopkins University and a Master of Fine Arts degree from the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. He has chaired the board of the Young Writers Project, served on the Vermont Legislative Committee on Pain and Palliative Care, and served on the advisory board of the New Hampshire Palliative Care Initiative. Stephen travels the country speaking and consulting on how to expand use of hospice, palliative care, and advanced directives. A performer on the guitar since he was 10 years old, Stephen P. Kiernan has recorded three CDs of solo instrumentals and composed music for dance, the stage, and documentary films. He lives in Vermont with his two sons. The Baker's Secret is a novel of World War II, a tale of courage, determination, optimism, and the resilience of the human spirit, set in a small Normandy village on the eve of D-Day. On June 5th, 1944, as dawn rises over a small town on the Normandy coast of France, Emmanuelle is making the bread that has sustained her fellow villagers in the dark days since the Germans invaded her country. Only 22, Emma learned to bake at the side of a master, Ezra Kuchen, the village baker since before she was born. Apprenticed to Ezra at 13, Emma watched with shame and anger as her kind mentor was forced to wear the six-pointed yellow star on his clothing. She was likewise powerless to help when they pulled Ezra from his shop at gunpoint, the first of many villagers stolen away and never seen again. In the years that her sleepy coastal village has suffered under the enemy, Emma has silently, stealthily fought back. Each day she receives an extra ration of flour to bake a dozen baguettes for the occupying troops. And each day she mixes that precious flour with ground straw to create enough dough for two extra loaves, contraband bread that she shares with the hungry villagers. Under the cold, watchful eyes of armed soldiers, she builds a clandestine network of barter and trade that she and the villagers use to thwart their occupiers. But her gift to the village is more than these few crusty loaves. Emma gives the people a taste of hope, the faith that one day the Allies will arrive to save them. I began my interview with Stephen P. Kiernan by asking how The Baker's Secret started for him. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
The Baker's Secret began in the men's locker room at the YMCA in Burlington, Vermont. I do a lot of swimming there, and there are older fellas that work out there or sometimes just kind of sit in the sauna for a while and then sit in the recliners and watch the news. And there was a day, I can't tell you what channel they had on, but they had it turned up pretty loud, and I was getting changed after exercise, and it was June 6th, 2009, so it was the 65th anniversary of D-Day, and the news report had coverage of David Cameron, who was the British Prime Minister at the time, speaking, and they had some clips from the remarks of Barack Obama, who was president at the time, and then there was going to be some kind of a speech by Sarkozy, who was the president of France, and they cut away to another story, and they didn't have anything of the French president, and that struck me as interesting. So I went home and just did like one quick Google search about the French experience in D-Day. And what I found out was that about 5,200 Americans died that day. Incredible sacrifice. And about 11,800 French people died that day. And I realized that there was a whole huge human story that had not been told. And quite apart from the deaths, As I began to think about it and dwell on it, I thought about what it must have been like to live under the occupation, and to be saved, to be liberated. And so I started reading about this and learning about this and interviewing people about this. I traveled to Normandy to see the place, and I realized that there are many, many kinds of triumphs that occurred in the course of the early 1940s in France, and that the sacrifice was enormous and the courage was enormous on all sides. And so that led me to really want to write a story that was about D-Day. And about half the novel occurs in the 36 hours before and including D-Day. And then I wrote some backstory in there. And the more I wrote that backstory, the more I realized that the experiences of these people were not unique to D-Day. That in fact they were emblematic of oppressed and occupied people probably for as long as there's been human history. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you read this book, you will not see the word France or Germany or America or Nazi. It's much more in kind of a fable almost voice that's about how people survive in a time of oppression and occupation. And sometimes the most defiant act that people can do in tough circumstances is to be kind to one another.
Mm. Okay. I like that. I really liked this line too, early in the book. There's a line, in a time of humiliation, the only dignified answer is cunning. It's funny, I took a note when I was reading it, and then when I went back to kind of type up my notes, I thought, oh, that must have been an epigraph. And then I realized, no, you just wrote that.
That was just a sentence in there.
It's just a sentence. I like it, though.
Well, it was a challenge to myself because it's about Emmanuel, my main character, my plucky, resourceful main character, and she's extremely cunning, and the challenge of that is that I'm not. And so as she's putting together this clandestine web of transactions, I had to think it up. And it was hard. It was very, very challenging to come up with her kind of clever way of helping people to survive and to keep their spirits up.
Yeah, I actually have we'll skip ahead now because I have a question about that. I wondered if you just spent a lot of time obsessed with creating sneaky ways for her to help her neighbors. I was starting to think of ways as
oh,
I read
really?
It.
You know,
I was
I'm
like,
glad
oh,
you
well,
did.
What would I do if I... So we should say that Emmanuel, who goes by Emma, is the baker in this tiny village. She was the apprentice baker, and then she becomes the baker through a series of events. And she's quite cunning, and she's doing things to help her neighbors survive.
Yes.
So, and some of the things she does are very cunning and sly and against the rules
and
of
yes,
the occupiers.
And it was a matter of keeping track. There were three documents. This isn't normally how I work, but there are three documents I relied on a lot for the writing of this book. One was a map of the coast of Normandy, and that had the D-Day, actual D-Day invasions on it. Another was a kind of a penciled-in map that I had of this town, Vergères, this small town on the coast in Normandy, and where everyone lived and where the different buildings were, and I needed to keep track. It was
no wait. Did you invent the town, or is it?
Yeah, no, I invented the
town. You invented the town.
I invented the town.
Okay.
Vergères is French for orchard, and that whole area, that region, the main product is apples. They're not for eating; they're for making calvados, brandy, and so there are orchards all over, and I live near an orchard as well, and so there's imagery about orchards that were helpful to have. But I had to have that map, and then the other thing that I needed to have was sort of my list of what everyone wanted and how she found ways to connect the dots and how the bread was the kind of the fuel in the tank or what started the motor. And although you could pick any point, you could say the tobacco, you could say the eggs, you could say the
light bulb. Yeah.
It's a very big light bulb in there. Yes, and all of this is her kind of outsmarting the occupying army, and each of the villagers knows their part, what they receive and what they give up. It's almost a stone soup. And that everyone has something that they
exactly.
can give up.
Exactly. It's funny, now that you've said that it's very fable-like, I hadn't thought about that before, but definitely this line of things that people need and things that people have to offer is very fable-like.
One of the, I've worked for about, 15 years or more in my non-writing life and in my writing life, in end-of-life care.
Uh-huh.
And I spent a lot of time learning about how people, as they approach the end of their lives, become more compassionate, and how people become more compassionate toward them.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of sins are forgiven at the end. And here is this town in which, at any moment, for any reason, any person can be killed. And many of them are.
Yeah.
And how they, despite being prickly neighbors with one another, take care of each other.
Yeah.
And how they develop that compassion for each other. Emma doesn't show it much if you look at her words, but if you look at her conduct, her deeds, she's the most loving of them all. That's the stone soup of it, is that they're all able to survive. And there's quite a cast in this. I haven't counted the number of characters, but, you know, there's dozens of people named in this town.
Yeah.
And they are all literally keeping one another alive, and
yeah.
It requires all of them.
It's interesting. I didn't get it all lost, even though there are a lot of characters. I thought that was impressive,
actually. I'm relieved to hear that.
Yeah, because I think it can be hard to write a book with a lot of characters and not lose your reader, but you didn't lose me at all.
Thank you.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about Emma's character. It's interesting. It's true what you say. She's a little bit of a curmudgeon in certain ways, and she's not perfect, but she's pretty great. And I just wondered if you could talk about developing her character.
Sure. Imagine this. Imagine that you are 20 years old, and you are beautiful, and you are plucky, and you have a lover, and you have a profession, and you have a supportive family, and you have all of these things that in any other time would lead to a certain kind of life. And then an invasion occurs, and an occupation occurs, and family members are killed, and your lover is conscripted to work in the enemy's factories, and all of your liberties are gone, your profession is taken away, and what becomes of you? What becomes of that girl? And for a while, it's really not clear. And then there's a point where she is sort of persuaded, and there's a time in which everyone is bit by bit persuading her. And then once she starts to take on the role of helping others, she finds more need and more want. And she's really much more interested in everyone else's wants, other than her own. And then there comes a point where she is determined, and she hardens to this role, and she is not going to be stopped. And in the later pages, she's in bad shape physically. She's been beaten up. She has not eaten. She's not even had a drink of water, and she is still persisting, as they say. She is still determined to help people because that is what her life has become. So even though she talks a tough game, she's the biggest softy in the whole book because she is determined to help her fellow man, the fellow woman in this little village.
Mm-hmm. I think
I quite fell in love with her.
Yeah.
You know? I did.
I think there's good conflict in the narrative because she changes as the book goes on, and at the beginning there are certain misconceptions about what she knows to be true and what she wants and who she wants to be. And I thought that was interesting, the way that changes as the book mm-hmm. goes on. One of the early things that she says is she does not want to become another Uncle Ezra, who was the original baker that she apprenticed under. And yet later she finds out that she didn't really know him as well as she thought she did.
No.
And that makes for a great story, I think, when things like that change.
Yes. You know, when she finds out that Uncle Ezra wasn't the curmudgeon that he appeared to
right.
be either, and that lots of people depended on him. And in fact, the food that he gave most people were recipes that she had botched. And she didn't know that she'd botched any recipes, and she thought that he would have told her. And so that she begins to change her... I mean, it's a step into adulthood when you begin to change your perception of the adults around you.
Right.
And to see their strengths and weaknesses in a more objective light. I have a son who's 22. And so I think about how he is smart and beautiful and how he is unaware, both. And that's part of his beauty, just like a kid learning their first words or learning to walk. It's a very adult version of learning to walk. He'd be embarrassed that I was talking about it. But I think about how deep his idealism is. even though he might never say it. You know, the Germans said that the Third Reich would last 1,000 years. And for Emma, that seems plausible. I mean, let's step back for 1 second. About 1.5 million Frenchmen died
right.
in World War I.
Right.
Okay, the male population has not recovered. It has not recovered by the time World War II comes around. And the men that remain, most of the Jewish men, are either killed or taken to the camps. And lots of other Frenchmen are put to forced labor, either building defenses along the coast, or they're sent to German factories so the German factory workers can join the army. The result is that the many, many, many of the heroes of the occupation time were women. And so if you look actually throughout this narrative, you see most of the men that are left behind are not men of strength and character, or they're essential, like the village veterinarian.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they're gone. The men of strength and character are gone, and it is really to the women to... And this has historical basis. It's really the challenges to the women to survive with these armies there. I read a number of novels about World War II in France, and in all of them, the German officer that is billeted in the house is polite and dashing and considerate, and in a couple of cases even apologetic, and that is a spectacular fiction that bears no resemblance to reality, which is rampant sexual assault and lots of violence and hostility and a much tougher actual scenario. So, you know, my agent and editor both were saying, where's the love story? Where's the love story? And I said, it's not going to be across battle lines.
No.
There is a love story in there, but it's not going to be across battle lines.
Yeah.
And so this is the heroism of these women that they try to keep everyone alive.
Yeah, Rosie the Riveter.
Yes,
except
exactly.
A different story
yes.
of Rosie the Riveter.
No, good point.
I wanted to ask you something about the voice of the narrative. I don't know if I would call it. It's not Emma's voice, and it's not necessarily your normal voice as a writer, but the voice of this narrative to me hints at another language and another culture, even though there are no foreign words in it. I thought that was so interesting. Did it take you a while to come to... Well, first of all, am I right? And secondly, did it take you a while to come to that?
Yes. The hardest thing about writing this novel was figuring out how to tell it. And I started it 4 times. One time I got 150 pages in. And I sent it to my editor, and she said, no. What you need to do is this. And what she said was so perfect.
Oh.
Her suggestion was so spot on. I was almost there, and she just pushed me, kind of kicked me in the behind, that last foot that I needed to go. And so it is a third person.
Yep.
And this is the first thing that I have ever published that isn't third person.
Oh, it's interesting.
It's always been first person.
Okay.
And so it's a departure. And it really took me, it took me months, maybe 6 months, to get to where I figured out the voice.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was able to write about 70 pages. And I was interrupted because I was touring at that point for the Hummingbird. And when I came back, when I finished the tour, I went directly to France to finish my research. And I've never been more rabid about needing to get something written. By the time I came back, I knew where my town was. I knew the landscape. I had the voice, and I had my story and my 3 maps. And then I wrote as fast as I ever have, getting the first draft out. It was just like pouring out of me. And there was still months and months and months of revision. But it was really, really fun 7 months or so, just round the clock. It was in my head.
Do you remember what your editor said, or is there any message there that you can share for other writers?
Oh, you know, we all have our trial and error, right? Mm-hmm. So the voice that I had come to, I was being coy. The voice I had come to is, do I talk about early drafts? Let's see. let me say this. It was going to be first person plural. So the first sentence of this book is, all through the days of war, the bread tasted of humiliation. The original first sentence was, all through those days of war, our bread tasted of humiliation. And one of the things that is a mystery through the story is who is the narrator? There is a baby that is born late in this book, and in the next to last page, it is revealed that she is the narrator. And my editor said, no.
Okay.
We're not going to spend 300 pages guessing who is telling us this story. No, it's not coy. It's annoying. Get that voice out of there. Which is why it's so great to have a strong-minded woman as your editor. Because she was absolutely right. It was a complete distraction. And sometimes it worked and was very poetic. And sometimes it was really an obstacle. Like, what would this narrator know? How would this narrator know it? That sort of thing. And so I just sliced all that out, and there it was. There was that voice that was not like French accent. It was nothing cartoonish. It was a kind of elevated diction.
Mm-hmm.
It was taking the time sometimes to be lovely, to let myself write in a more kind of poetic voice, and I pay a lot of attention to sound through this, and you can find, you can pick a page and read it out loud, and you'll see there's sounds. I'm playing with sound all the way through it. You know, there's one point where I'm describing the hedgerows, and in France, the hedgerows are not like other places, certainly not like Vermont. They're much thicker, much denser. They're like walls with these big trees in the middle of them. And I describe them as these huge mute eunuchs. Now, I don't do that kind of sound stuff, or I haven't before. And giving myself permission to have that U sound rhyming through the description was really fun. And yeah. I had to take a lot of it out because it got too purple. But it was fun to put that in there and say, okay, I'm going to pay attention to sound. I'm going to pay attention to diction in a different way. Instead of being as concise as I possibly can I allow myself a simile here? Things like that.
Yeah, because you come from a background of journalism, so probably you have never allowed yourself that much ornamentation, I would think.
All of my former editors in my newspaper career are spinning right now. They have set stomachs. They don't know why. They're not feeling very good.
Okay. You mentioned that you did a lot of research, and you have already mentioned that you traveled to that region of France. Did any of your research overlap with the research you had done for the Hummingbird? I'm just curious.
No.
Because that was the Pacific.
It was.
So there was.
And it was years before. But, you know, there's things about the research in this that are fantastic. One is that General and then later President Eisenhower understood that what he was doing in what was called Operation Overlord was of mythic stature. And so in the course of that day, he had something like 100 photographers documenting the day, and he had people taking oral histories of the combatants that day. And in fact, there's the Eisenhower Center outside of New Orleans. They have something like 3,000 oral histories. There's a fantastic special that Walter Cronkite did in 1964 on the 20th anniversary of the invasion, where he and Eisenhower walk the beaches, walk the American cemetery. And so those are pretty powerful. The documents are really powerful. I also interviewed a survivor of Omaha Beach. And that was an interview that left me feeling about 1 inch tall. It's a pretty remarkable human being to have survived that and tell the story all these years later.
From where?
From Middlebury, Vermont.
Oh, okay.
And he was from California originally, and he's hale and hearty and spry. But the most powerful thing about it, quite honestly, was the place, of course, the place itself. Place always informs fiction, right? Setting is part of the character's destiny. But that's particularly so in Normandy, because the invasion happened so fast that they left everything behind. Think of it this way. When the Allies invaded in Sicily, it took them basically a year to liberate Rome. When the Allies invaded Normandy, it took them 10 weeks to liberate Paris. The severity, the intensity, and the speed were so great that when they swept past the German defenses, they left them there. It's all still there. You can go to a beach, very nice beach. There was a guy paddleboarding by this beach, okay? Beautiful beach. And there is a steel-reinforced, 6-foot-thick concrete pillbox right there on the beach to shoot at anybody who comes abroad. You come across these array of guns with 40-foot barrels that are in a semicircle near Aramanche. You drive across a bridge, and there is a machine gun pointed at you. It's all still there. It's extremely vivid. And that made it pretty easy to envision where the machine gun nests had been, why that nest was there by that bridge, what that installation was for, and to see particularly what the German intent was. And it's very sobering, and that's without even talking about the cemeteries, which are their own.
Oh my goodness, I bet.
You know, the thing all by themselves. But it made it really easy to imagine. In fact, it was as a result of seeing all of those places that I said there was a day, there was a moment, because I was looking for where my imaginary town would be, and there was a moment when I was moved by seeing these huge guns and thinking about the people who had died because of these guns and what it said about human nature that someone invented these guns and put them there. Mm-hmm. And I walked away and I was about a half mile away and I was at the edge of this orchard and I realized here, this is where my town will be and here's the orchard, so I will call this town Vergère.
Yeah.
And so that's how I found myself standing in the place where my imaginary village would be.
That's cool.
Then I needed my maps to keep track of where everyone was.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the cunning things that Emma does. My favorite, and probably the sort of most, the one that runs through the book the most, is her decision to add straw dust. She grinds straw into, like, almost like a flour to add to the dough and stretch the loaves that she makes for the soldiers. She's supposed to make 12 loaves of bread each day for the soldiers that are occupying the occupying force, and she instead stretches it so she has 2 more loaves to share with starving villagers. Did that come from anything real you had run across, or did you come up with that?
Well, I think it may have been just because when I try to make baguettes, they come out tasting like straw. I needed a starting point for her whole machine of exchange and barter. And there's a way in which, you know, she is trained by this baker, Uncle Ezra, with such precision. He's such a taskmaster. And there's a day when the commandant smells baking bread and comes and helps himself to a loaf and takes a bite and says, "Oh, you people certainly have a knack."
Yeah.
You know, which is almost like he's being offhand about the entire French
culture. Right.
He says, so you will make 12 loaves a day for the officers. And she does so. And after a number of months, she realizes that there are people in the village that are starving. And so she puts like a thimbleful of ground up straw, grinds it into powder, and puts it in the loaves and spends the night wondering if she's going to be found out, if she's going to be killed, what's going to happen. And in fact, they don't even notice. And so she adds a little more and a little more and a little more until one day one of the officers says, "Have you changed your recipe? The crusts are getting hard." So she dials it back a little bit from that, but it's enough that she can make 2 extra loaves. And that's just the beginning. Now she has something that she can barter with. Now she has something she can give someone who is starving. Now she has something to feed herself and her grandmother, although she doesn't eat much of it. Her bread even becomes a communion bread in the church in this little town. And which, you know, might be getting a little heavy with the symbolism, but it really is about the beginning. It's the beginning of it, right, is bread to start. What's more basic in a time of starvation than bread? But lo and behold, that bread can be traded for fuel. And the fuel can help a guy run his boat to catch fish. And if he catches a fish, that can be given to this person to get eggs. And there becomes this whole mechanism. And then you get tobacco, and that goes to someone else. And all of the pieces of it start with her ability to expand the bread. And that actually, it takes all of her skills as a baker to be able to conceal all that straw. And she's discovered, like, she needs to add straw, a salt, too, to cover the straw. But that it requires her skill to do that. We begin with bread, right? We break bread together. This is a culture that has turned the act of feeding themselves into an art form. And now it's been turned into a survival form. Mm-hmm. And it becomes spiritual.
Now, you just mentioned her grandmother. How do you say the name?
Meme.
And you've worked a lot with the elderly or with
some
end-of-life care. And I just, I was very struck by that character. I wondered if you can talk a little bit about writing the fate of the elderly during the war.
Yes. I still haven't figured out quite why the occupying army doesn't kill her. But they don't. She is Emma's grandmother. She has a fairly advanced dementia with moments of lucidity, and she's quite physically strong because she's lived on a farm all her life. What I found was I never wanted to condescend to her. I wanted the relationship between Emma and her to be loving, and I wanted her confusion to be a very human and compelling confusion. And then something happened, and this is where discovery is so much the fun of writing fiction. She never speaks more than one word at a time, except for very late in the book, at a very dramatic moment when she says two words at a time. And, but what I can tell you is that a silent character is incredibly powerful, and that their words have a kind of Oz. They have a great resonance. I am Oz, a kind of resonance. And so when I started, she was going to be a very minor character. But I found that her silent presence was so powerful that she ends up being a very important character. And it's sort of the critical, most exciting moment, perhaps, in the story. Lo and behold, she's the one who does the dramatic thing. And that's when she says four words. But it's in two sets of two. I didn't get carried away. So there's a lot of... I learned something about character. And I'm different in board meetings now. I speak less. It matters. Because it's so powerful when she ultimately does open her mouth.
Yeah.
When she speaks, her word, her one word is always very true.
That reminds me of another character in the book. Is it Odette?
Odette.
And she actually understands German, but she doesn't let on that she understands German, and so she can pick up a lot by just being silent and listening. And
that's right. That's right. Everyone thinks that she's just a grouchy woman who runs a cafe, and actually she knows a lot of what's going on. This, I should say, you know, one of the things I really steered clear of, for the most part, in this novel is the resistance. And it's because I didn't want these people to be fundamentally political. I read a lot about the resistance and the courage and heroism of those folks, but I really wanted this to be ordinary folk.
Yeah.
Who are trying to survive. And so there are some of them who brush up against the resistance. Odette, for example, runs a cafe. There are German officers eating and drinking there all the time. And she speaks German. She grew up outside of Mainz. And so she's listening. And it's never explicitly said, but it's implied that she's passing along what she hears.
Right.
And so there's a little of that, but I really did not want to make this political. As I say, I'm trying to transcend just June 6, 1944, and make it more about, you know, was there someone like Emma during the Siege of Leningrad? I believe there was. Mm-hmm. You know, is there someone like Emma in Aleppo today? I certainly hope so. Mm-hmm. Because I believe that that is what she possesses is a nobility and compassion that is part of human nature, I believe. And it's really a thing that gives me hope.
Okay, yeah. There are marks that are left around town. They are V marks.
Mm-hmm.
Did that come from a real story? I kept thinking as I read, like, is this from a real story?
And it's really interesting. I believe that they're real, but I'm not sure. I may have made them up. certainly the V was a sign that people used who were, you know, opposed to the Axis.
Right.
And what happens is every time that Emma makes a loaf, before she puts it in the oven with her thumbnail, she puts a V in it. And then Vs appear in various places. And it's almost like a signal among the villagers that's some kind of a sign that they will prevail one day. And they do things like just leave books standing on their spine, so they make a V, or they leave a matchbook open, or they put sticks or rocks in the shape of a V. And then when certain things happen, calamitous things happen, Vs begin to appear in unusual places that are very much a challenge and to the authority of the occupying army. And I believe it's clear in the end who is making those V's, but it's not clear until very, very late in the book. As people are questioning it, even they don't know. But it's a sign of defiance. Mm-hmm. In a time when you have no weapons, you have no radio, you have really no contact with the outside world, and you are oppressed at every turn, you have a curfew, you're a grown person in your own house, and you must be in at 9 o'clock kind of thing. All of these sorts of things, in addition to just nothing to eat, and your crops taken, and the milk from your cows taken, and all of that. How do people retain their dignity? How do they maintain? Well, we know in the American South in the 1800s that the slaves sang and they prayed. In the case of Emma and her villagers, her fellow villagers, it's the V. And whenever they see a V, it almost doesn't matter who put it there. It just means, yep, we're here.
Right.
We're still
it's like
alive.
Solidarity.
We're still, yes, exactly.
Whether or not it's political, it's solidarity.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And there it is, you know, hung up in a tree, so high that the occupying army has to cut the tree down.
Yeah.
To get it out of there.
Right.
And because the occupying army understands that it's a symbol of defiance as well.
Yeah.
Right. It can be very small but meaningful.
One moment that I found really interesting was Emma has this opportunity to take revenge on the soldiers that she despises who have taken so much from her. And we don't have to say what happens, but she makes a sort of snap decision. And I just thought it was really interesting to give her that opportunity and then to see which path she takes. I think that was just like this great moment of character development, because even though I knew her pretty well by then, I wasn't quite sure what she would do, and I liked that. So did that... Was that something that you planned for a long time to offer to her? Did that just come about through the process of writing?
I knew. Well, the question is, I don't want to give things away.
No, don't give things away.
Let me say this: there will be opportunities during wartime for acts of vengeance or retribution, or what may feel like justice. And the question is, how far would you go?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, putting a V up in a tree, for example, well, that's pretty small. But if you have a moment in which, you know, a senior officer is unguarded and you could pick up a gun that's been left there, do you do it or not? And how do you decide? Most warfare does not grant the luxury of contemplation about this. There's necessity. There are the utmost imperatives. But for Emma and for the villagers, this is a thing to think about.
Mm.
And there are things that occur. You know, at one point someone poisons a bunch of animals of the occupying army, for example. And, you know, I think the reader by the end of the book knows who did that. I hope so. But I think, you know, will Emma go far enough? She will have several opportunities to commit acts of violence. And she will profess wanting to commit them. But when the opportunity arises, there's a moral dilemma for her. And I can't say that I planned it. I did plan the second one. And I didn't think she'd do what she did. She surprised me. But by then, the first one had occurred. So mm-hmm. It wasn't a surprise, I guess.
Well, and she had time to think about the decision she'd made at that first opportunity.
Right. Yes, she got two swings at the pitch.
Yeah, right, so. Which doesn't always happen.
Yes.
Okay, I wanted to just ask you if you are writing anything new
yet. I am. I've begun a new novel, and it is enormously difficult.
Oh, no!
And but that's good for me. I do better, you know, as we're speaking here, I'm about to go on tour for The Baker's Secret. And it is a time that it's very exhilarating. And it's lovely to meet with readers, and their reviews are coming during that time and all that. And it's very easy to kind of lose touch with the ground. And the thing that keeps me on an even keel through that is if I have another idea already cooking.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, you know, I'd begun The Baker's Secret and was about 70, 75 pages in when The Hummingbird came out. And that was ballast. And likewise, The Madman's Mistress is my ballast right now.
The Madman's Mistress.
The Madman's Mistress. What can I say? In 2006, a painting by Jackson Pollock sold for $120 million. The most ever paid for a work of art of any kind in human history. Shortly thereafter, a woman came forward and said, I was Pollock's mistress. He made me a painting. It's been in my private possession all this time. And Sotheby's, I'd like you to auction it for me. And a young woman who works for Sotheby's is given the job of authenticating the painting and confirming the affair. And that's, I guess, about as far as I want to go with
okay,
it at this point.
Okay, that's very interesting.
It's just, it's been, the research has been absolutely fantastic and mind-blowing, and the abstract expressionists are the weirdest, wildest artists I've ever encountered, and I'm a little overwhelmed by my topic right now. It's funny how, like, you know, D-Day I can make sense of, but abstract expressionism that was
these
made
guys are
12
nuts.
Years later, those guys are not exactly. That's the wild stuff.
Okay.
It's true.
That sounds great. You said you're about to go on book tour. What does that look like? And I saw that you were doing a blog tour, and I wanted to ask you about that, because I don't think I've ever asked a guest about being on a blog tour.
Well, the blog tour is not mine.
Right.
That is, bloggers are writing about the book, and I've been in communication with them.
Oh.
So, for example, there's a guy who's got a blog that's page 69. You know, write about page 69 in your book, and is it representative of the book? And it's a random page number he picks. In my case, it happens to be kind of an indicative page number, so it worked out pretty well. I was in his blog a couple of years ago for another book, and page 69 was like four lines before a new chapter, so I lied. I looked at 68 and 70 and picked the one I thought was more interesting. But there's another one that's called My Book, The Movie, in which you describe if it were cast, who would the cast be, and that sort of thing. And so I'm communicating with those bloggers, but that's the extent of a blog tour.
So who comes up with the bloggers? Is that something your publicist does for you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And some of them now, you know, I've interacted with before, and so, you know, they're online friends, you know. The physical tour, the geographic tour that I'm doing, I'm looking forward to, and it's going to be different from past ones in a couple of ways that I really like. It's not going to be national. It's going to be regional,
mm-hmm.
New York and New England. And I'm delighted. The air travel part of it is brutal. And the quality of life on tour is kind of just above rodent.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is you have 2 hours each day that is, you know, as much fun as you can have with your clothes on. And then it's just so great to meet with readers and to meet bookstore owners and to have this solitary art form create a moment of spontaneous community. It's really a privilege. It really is enormous privilege. But it's also really exhausting. The last tour I did was 29 events all over the country, and there were places where I had good crowds and places where I didn't, and all that. It was still a lot more sort of roller coaster. This tour, virtually every bookstore that I'm going to, I know the owner personally. I've spoken there a couple of times before. I know there's a readership there. Because I'm not in airports and in cars, I will probably get exercise, so I won't be feeling quite so claustrophobic. I'll probably get better sleep. And it's not to say I'm not going to crisscross the state like crazy or the New England like crazy. I've got an event in one part of Massachusetts one night and in the opposite part of Massachusetts the next morning and then across Massachusetts to southern Vermont the next day. Mm-hmm. So I'll have three events in 24 hours and I'll probably drive about 700 miles.
Yeah.
You know, but
wow.
That's still better than being in a plane twice during that time. It really is. And, you know, and each of those nights I'll spend with a friend.
Yeah.
So it really, I think it'll be more humane. And and I'm going to have some fun. I believe I've been to a couple of book tours that have been wonderful, and I've been to many that were really tedious. And so I try as hard as I can to have very interesting events. I have a t-shirt cannon so that certain people who meet certain criteria that night will get a garment to take home with the book cover on it. last tour, I had peppermint patties, those little Yorks, and people, if they did certain things, I would throw them candy in the course of it. Obviously, the Baker's Secret, there are a couple of events in this tour that are going to be in which local bakeries will be providing yummies.
Oh, yeah.
Also, cool. Because of the theme of the book about taking care of each other, several of them will be benefits for local food shelves, which I'm delighted about.
That's great.
And and there are going to be surprises. I'm going to make it lively. My first novel tour, one of the characters in the Curiosity was a serious deadhead. He listened to Grateful Dead jams in headphones all day long, kind of how he managed his hyperactive intellect. And so people would come to my events, and the Grateful Dead would be playing. And it's really interesting to arrive at a bookstore event, and there's Grateful Dead playing. It just says it's not going to be your ordinary reading. So I'm looking forward to the tour. In fact, I can't wait, because I think some of the cunning will be amusing to people. Telling them some of that stuff, some of the cleverness of Emma will be amusing to people. And because D-Day is a compelling thing to talk about, too.
Yeah, yeah. What have you read lately that you might recommend to listeners?
I just finished Lincoln at the Bardo.
Oh, how was that?
Oh, it's a masterpiece. You know, a short story writer all his life. He has written a novel that is unique in its conception. I remember years ago, like 30-plus years ago, when postmodernism was the great discussion in fiction, you know, that all the stories had been told and we needed to invent new ways to tell them. And the result was so much self-indulgent pap. And now we have, unfortunately, come to our senses and recognize the power of story is supreme. And from an aesthetic standpoint. Yet, there are ways to tell stories in with new methods and with new ways. If you think about the narrative voice of The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, for example.
Right.
That limited narrative voice enriches the story profoundly.
Or like your earlier talk about your first draft reminded me of The Virgin Suicides, which is written in the first person plural.
There you go. What was the book, The Lovely Bones, which was narrated by a person who was dead?
Right.
So what I can tell you without giving anything away is that George Saunders has invented a new way of telling this story.
Oh, cool.
It's unique in my experience, and it enables all kinds of additional humor and lots of very, very touching moments.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it is inventing words, but most of it is the way the story is actually told, and it is not weird experimental. It's very cogent, and it flows, and it's lovely. I just finished The Stars of Fire by Anita Shreve, which I liked very well. I liked Celine by Peter Heller. Great characters. There's something about a private investigator who's an old lady who's, you know, dragging around an oxygen tank, but it's a good shot. It's a really lovely book. You know, I got completely suckered by The Sleepwalker by Chris Bojalian. I was sure I knew who done it, and I was wrong.
Yeah.
I loved Georgia by Dawn Tripp. Fantastic novelization of Georgia O'Keeffe's life. That ends up being about a lot. It's actually one of my favorite feminist novels, maybe ever. And I'm reading Stolen Beauty right now by Laura Lico Albanese. That is terrific. Also a World War II story. And then I'm reading tons and tons of things for the book that I'm writing. And I'm actually almost to the point where I have to stop my pleasure reading and just do the background reading because there's so much I need to learn for this topic.
Yeah. Okay, that's a lot. That's great. I love it when people can come up with a lot of good new ideas to read. Okay, I want to just, I have one last question for you, Stephen. There's tragedy in this book. There's sadness. There's, in particular, one early scene that really got me right at the beginning. Well, not right at the beginning, where a man is executed I just found it devastating and very real and unexpected. You know, he's kind of like dragged out of his place of business and killed. Talk a little bit. Can you give any advice to people who might be trying to write the tragedy of war and want to keep it real and not cliche or, you know, like falling into something we've seen before?
You know, I believe that the two hardest things to write are a killing and a kiss, because to be original with either is very difficult without being cliched. And I think about Billy Bathgate by E.L. Doctorow comes to mind. Right, the opening scene in that novel is a boy, 14, 15 years old, is watching as a guy is being put in what they call cement overshoes, right? He's a bucket full of cement, and he's made to stand in it while the cement sets, and then he goes overboard in the Long Island Sound, and he's killed that way by organized crime. This is a cliche, but it's not when he takes the time to imagine it fully. And so, for example, there's, you know, the gangster, and then there's his henchman who's just keeping the gun pointed at the guy who's going to die so he doesn't try to escape. And then there's kind of the butler, and he's the guy who mixes the cement, and when it's time for the guy who's going to die to step his foot in, he says, wait, and he rolls up his pant leg so that his foot, his actual skin, will be in the cement. And then he sits down, and they have to wait for the cement to dry, and they've got to just sit around for 20 minutes and shoot the bull. And it is absolutely terrifying, and it is so fully imagined. So I have never written a killing before. This is a war book, and so there are killings in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I made myself slow down and imagine it fully. And it made me enormously sad. It also gave me a kind of resolve, you know, that there would be justice. And I didn't know what form it would take until I got there in the writing of it. I like the form that it took, but there was a kind of brutality to it that I had never gone to. You know, Justin Cronin is a good pal of mine. He wrote this fantastic, sprawling trilogy, the Passage trilogy.
I've read the first one. I haven't gotten to the second one yet, but not because I don't want to. It's very good.
It's a trip. And the third one, too, you know, is the biggest of the three, and it's a massive, rewarding trip.
Mm-hmm.
And in the course of that, these virals that eat people, you know, he said you have to really be willing to let any character die. And that's a really different way to plot a book.
Right.
Is to say, you know, this character may die, that character may die. And that the reader doesn't know. Because what happens then is when a character is threatened, it is completely plausible that this character that you've come to care for and to visualize and to imagine will be gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so this, there are several executions in particular of characters that you think, they're going to be, I've got this character with me the whole way. And Justin's advice about being willing to, being not willing, but able to comprehend, to conceive that any character could die.
Yeah.
It gives you a kind of authorial freedom. And it's scary, because we do get invested in our characters. And if somebody's meaningful at the beginning, they're going to be meaningful at the end. But sometimes their absence is even more meaningful. And when someone dies, it is a motivator for everyone who cared for that person. It shapes their character in profound ways for the rest of the story. So when it comes to writing a killing or a kiss, I think it's about the specificity of that moment. And I wrote that execution in a very, very specific way, right on down to how the executioner puts out his cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
That he's smoking before he does this. And obviously that's how he's keeping himself calm, his own facade. But how, there's a way that you would put out your cigarette if you're about to kill someone there that's not like normal.
Yeah.
And I just took the time to imagine it. And, you know, in Doctorow's fantastic rendition, if you don't like Billy Bathgate, just read those first five pages or so. That guy, you know, they finally have to hoist this heavy bucket to the side of the boat, and the guy who's going to die has to sort of help them.
Right.
And then over he goes, down he goes. And that's the beginning. That's what the first thing that we know about Billy, as he's a boy who saw this.
Mm-hmm.
He was trusted, and he was there. And now he's got the weight of that.
Right.
So,
I guess being as specific as possible.
I think that's really good advice. That's really good advice. Right. For I think for any sort of culmination of, I mean, I specifically asked about tragedy, but any sort of emotional culmination too, that something's leading up to something big, specificity of detail is going to really deliver it very well, I think.
There's even just good old suspense.
Yeah.
Just slow it down.
Yeah.
Slow it down.
Yeah, great. I want to mention the book is The Baker's Secret. It's a novel by Stephen P. Kiernan, and it is published by William Morrow. Thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Fantastic pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with Vermont author Stephen P. Kiernan. His new novel, which we discussed, is The Baker's Secret, just out from William Morrow. You can read more about his work at stephenpkiernan.com, and that's Stephen with a PH. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Stephen P. Kiernan. The book he's now writing involves the difficult task of describing art. Stephen recommends reading W.H. Auden's Musée des Beaux-Arts, one of the best examples he can recommend of writing inspired by a painting. And in this case, the painting is The Fall of Icarus by Bruegel. I'm going to put a link to the poem on the podcast site, and actually the link is going to also show you the painting. If you have a look there, read the poem, and then find a work of art that is unfamiliar to you and write about it. Stephen says, having now done both for different projects, he finds writing about music easier than writing about art, and that's usually the one that people say is so difficult. But I thought this was interesting what he said. He said, like narrative, music occurs through time. Both music and narrative have movement, crescendo, culmination, completion, whereas a painting is a moment apprehended that does not have narrative. So give it a try. Write about a painting. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as podcasts, free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And then, of course, you can stream the show live each week at 993wbtv.org. That's Mondays at 3. And then second hour features reruns and possibly other new content down the road. We're not there yet. I think that'll be after we are broadcasting. And when we are broadcasting, it'll be on 99.3 FM, and we will be sure to let you know. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. Have a great week.